home of the stars, through the airwaves and on the big screen. Coming to you live from Hollywood, it's Rated G Radio with your host, Garrett Miller.
Hey everybody, welcome back to Rated G Radio. I'm your host, Garrett Miller, and we're live for the next hour, and very shortly, we're going to be welcoming back to the show Stephen Michael Scheer. He's going to be talking about his writing career, his TV specials, projects he can't talk about. We're going to see what he's willing to spill the beans on tonight, and I can't wait to have him back. Always a crowd favorite. So Stephen Fitzgerald in Tennessee, yes, he's live. Call if you want. Tony G out of Hackensack, yes, he's live. Call if you want. Angela, yes, he's live. Call if you want. Everybody who's been asking me all day, is Stephen really going to be on the show? Yes, he's here. So if you'd like to call in and gush over him, please do so at 323-657-1493, and we'll bring him on in just a moment. Real quick recap of what we're going to be doing for the rest of the week and where we've been, so you kind of have a flavor of what's happening in the world of Rated G Radio. Last night on Monday's show, we had Dr. Annie Ulrich. She was talking about the December Energy Update, the new moon on December 12th, and so much more. Very popular episode. Go back and check that out if you'd like to find out more information on what your energy is in store for the rest of this month. Tomorrow and Thursday, we have energy healers Zoe Niklaus and Adrian Blackwell on the show. Tomorrow's 7 o'clock. Thursday's at 7:30 p.m. And you say, why is it a half an hour different? I'm going to tell you why right now. I'm going to be a guest, I guess that's what you call it, when I'm going to appear on itmattersradio.com with Monica and Kenneth. You'll see a little ad for their show right here on the program as the ads cycle through. They're going to be bringing me on at 6 p.m. on Thursday night for an hour, or a portion thereof, talking about my album Blonde Jesus, my music video Guess What, It's Christmas Time, music, and so much more. I don't know what I'm going to be wearing for this. I've never done a video interview before, so I may actually even, you know, comb my hair. We're going to see. But that all starts live this Thursday at 6 p.m. Pacific Standard Time on itmattersradio.com. And then that show goes till 7, and I said, Adrian, can I have like a half an hour to go to the bathroom and, you know, get a cup of tea or something like that? So we're going to start Rated G Radio on Thursday night at 7:30. And then Friday, we have the pleasure of welcoming the musical duo, The Humble Grapes, out of Brooklyn, New York. They're going to be talking about their new single called, you know, coincidentally enough, Brooklyn Bridge, and that starts at 9 a.m. on this Friday, December 11th, so tune in as your schedule permits. Of course, all of the shows are available on demand, so, you know, if you've missed any portion thereof, or you claim that you were on a, you know, on an airplane or had to work or something like that, you can always go back and listen to the link. I'm now making it even easier by having the show broadcast on iTunes as a podcast. So you can go to iTunes and download Rated G Radio as a podcast and always get all of the episodes. You know, it's better if you're stranded on a desert island that way. So you've always got, you know, hours and hours and hours of entertainment. But tonight, we are going to be welcoming back Stephen Michael Scheer. I'm going to actually read his bio so you can really understand how impressive it is to have a gentleman of this stature on the line with us. Okay, so are you ready? Because I never read people's bios, because I just say, welcome to the show. But here you go, because I want you to really take note of this incredible talent. Stephen Michael Scheer grew up in Illinois, Michigan, and Arkansas. At age 11, he wrote his first play, Helen and Ellen in the Wilderness. For several years, he was with the Academy of Motion Pictures Arts and Sciences. He directed his first film, Sylvia and Sally of the Sand Dunes. While in college, he also earned a BSE in music and a minor in psychology. He's hosted TV shows called The Movies on CBS affiliates while also in school, and wrote film and book reviews for such nationally recognized publications as Film Collectors Registry. Mr. Scheer is also a former model and actor. He's appeared on TV. Here's what really made him my favorite. He's been on the show Dallas. You know, back in the day. And I just went, you've been on Dallas! And I knew we had to be BFFs right after that. He's also starred in Off-Broadway in the Samuel French Award-winning play The Appointment. He's directed the New York stage success The Last of September. He's acted in films beginning with Split Image in 1982 with Elizabeth Ashley and Peter Fonda. And more recently, Flying By in 2009 with the late Patricia Neal. And achy breaky heart himself, Mr. Billy Ray Cyrus, and also worked with the documentary The Green Girl in 2013. His first book, which we've had him on the show to talk about a couple of times, and everybody went nuts, and I said, this is a good thing, we have to get Stephen back on the show. But it was Patricia Neal, An Unquiet Life, and that was published in 2006. It's considered the definitive biography of the beloved actress, his longtime friend, and muse. His second book, which we're talking about tonight, is Beautiful, The Life of Hedy Lamarr, and that was put out in 2010. And we're going to have him back sometime in 2016 to talk about Gloria Swanson, the ultimate star. There's more, but now I'm out of breath. So now I'm going to say, without further ado, Stephen, Michael, sure, welcome back to the show. How are you?
Well, I'm pretty good, Garrett. That was quite a build-up. I don't know if I can live up to it or not.
I got that off your Amazon profile, so I hope it's all right.
Well, yes, it's all right. But I appreciate that. That was a good read.
How have you been?
I've been pretty good. I've been busy. I finished working on, as a matter of fact, we're talking about Hedy Lamarr tonight. And I just finished my participation in an PBS American Masters feature documentary film on Hedy and her life, her career, and her invention, which will air nationally next November on PBS stations. However, they are going to theatrically release it over in Europe. So I'm hoping that it might be in consideration for Oscar consideration for feature-length documentary, because it's a long overdue documentary on Hedy, and I'm very glad to have participated in it. Peter Bogdanovich is in it, Mel Brooks, Hedy Lamarr's children, Robert Osborne, innumerable people that I don't even know who the other participants are, but It's a project that I'm really glad that I stepped into it and was asked to participate, because I think it's finally going to give Hedy Lamarr the recognition that I felt many years ago when I decided to do this book, that I felt that she deserved. So I don't know the title of it yet. They've got a working title, something about Hedy Lamarr and her invention. It is a PBS documentary, so they are going to focus on the scientific part of it. But, of course, they are going to do the complete life and career as well, and that's where my participation was involved.
How long is the special going to be? Is it like a two-hour documentary, or...?
My understanding, it's about 95 minutes, and
okay.
It's soup to nuts from her beginning as a child in Vienna. She was born right prior to the outbreak of World War I. Through her years as a successful European actress, a minor actress, and her film Ecstasy, which caused quite a sensation on both sides of the Atlantic, her coming over to the United States in 1937, signing with Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer, becoming a star in A motion pictures with Clark Gable, Walter Pidgeon, John Garfield, James Stewart. She made major motion pictures, none of which became classics per se, like Gone with the Wind, San Francisco, El Cid, or anything, or El Cid, Ben-Hur, or films like that. No spectacular epics. However, she did hand in some mighty fine performances, and it also talks about her efforts during World War II to aid and abet her adopted country. It goes in then to the documentary, my understanding is, goes into in depth the scientific invention, the patent that she took out during the war, which the government did not know what to do with until the Cuban Missile Crisis. It also talks about her decline and her later years, her recognition. And I was very, very pleased that all three of Hedy's children, her adopted son and her two natural children, participated in this project as well, because it promises to be a very definitive project. It's being produced by Reframed Pictures, which is headed up by Susan Sarandon and her two partners. Alexandra Dean is the director of the film, and I'm just really anticipating the impact it's going to have on the population of the world who use cell phones. Most people don't understand that Hedy Lamarr was much more than just a film actress. Indeed, she was about the only actor or actress, if you will, who left a double legacy, that of her film canon and also that of scientific invention.
So that's what we're going to see next November on PBS.
Yeah.
So I will have to absolutely find that and tune in. That sounds fascinating, but what's more intriguing to me is Beautiful, The Life of Hedy Lamarr, which I dove into today, and I need to apologize to you because I have become accustomed to getting these short little big print, big spaced books from authors that I can whiz through in a couple of hours in the last couple of months, and I've been very grateful because they've been interesting reads. But then I get really what film historians or just historians in general will love. And it's been a hot minute since you've been on, Stephen, so I need to apologize to you that I didn't get as far into your book as I would have liked, because it's a book where I actually needed to concentrate a little bit, which was stimulating for me, fascinating to read, and I stopped writing about 20 questions because I know we get really chatty, but I have so many things that I wanted to talk to you about in the book, and I haven't even gotten to the good stuff yet, because the good stuff is I'm through chapter 6 and loved every single minute of it, but there's so much about her early years that I had no clue about, and you are bringing everything to life.
Well, a lot of that hasn't been written about. When Hedy Lamarr came to the United States in 1937, Louis B. Mayer didn't quite know what to do with her. She couldn't speak English, and so he gave her directives to learn the language and to assimilate into our culture as quickly as possible, and then he lent her out to Walter Wanger over at United Artists, and he put her in a film called Algiers. Algiers starred Charles Boyer, and it was the film where allegedly his character, Pepe Lomoco, said to her character, Gabby, let me take you to the Casbah. Well, that line was never actually uttered in the film, but people relate to Hedy Lamarr's first film appearance with that particular film. However, she had led quite an amazing life prior to coming to Hollywood. As a matter of fact, I was quite fascinated with some of the facts that I was able to uncover through European bibliothèques and archives, also through a lot of libraries and personal interviews, etc. I think this is about the most definitive book on Hedy Lamarr. There was a Films of book that came out many years ago, and of course her own notorious autobiography, unquote, Ecstasy and Me, which was actually ghostwritten. There are passages, factual passages, when Hedy is talking about her career in Ecstasy and Me, which are very true, and they ring true, and they ring in her voice. But most of that particular autobiography is fictional, at least exaggerated, minimally exaggerated. At any rate, the reason I chose to do Hedy Lamarr was because there hadn't been a book about her, and she was a major, major actress during the war years, most certainly. I found when I was a young kid, I thought she was perhaps one of the most beautiful women I'd ever seen in my life, and so when I began my initial research, I started going through newspaper archives and newspaper clippings at the AMPAS, the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences Library out in L.A., and I found that there was quite a lot of litigation going on in Hedy's life, especially toward the end of her life. It was just one lawsuit after another, and I had my drawbacks about doing this particular book. It wasn't Patricia Neal. It wasn't something I was used to. I figured it wouldn't be, but still I wasn't expecting a lot of things that I was finding, so I wasn't for sure if I was going to do this or not. But I kicked it around in my mind, and I thought of Beautiful, and how ironic that title really was when it came to pass, if you will, in my research, that I found out during World War II, she and eccentric music composer George Antheil gave the government a patent, created in their minds a patent on how to direct torpedoes to hit their marks, because America was severely, well, the Allies were severely losing in the early days of World War II. In the North Atlantic, the torpedoes were missing their marks. German submarines were becoming quite victorious in what they were doing. Hedy figured she knew a little bit about science, and she knew a little bit about this and that, and George Antheil as well, through his music, came up with the 88 key roll, piano key roll on receiving and intercepting transmissions, frequency hopping. However, the government, when they received the patent, didn't quite know what to do with it, and it sat dormant throughout the many years until 1962, actually, when it was readdressed. 1959, the patent expired, so Hedy and George Antheil did not make any money on that. But in 1962, during the Cuban Missile Crisis, the government had to find some way that our ships could communicate with each other without the Russians intercepting. So they readdressed her patent. So by the time of the Vietnam conflict in the late 60s, wireless communication was used in missile warfare, and eventually every cell phone, every Wi-Fi that we have today goes back. The nucleus of their possibility is from the patent that Hedy and George Antheil took out in 1942. So at any rate, I found that a very fascinating thing, and I also found it very sad that a beautiful woman of that era of the 30s and 40s was, if she was an actress especially, she was little more than set decoration. And the contemporary newspaper reports at that time, New York Times, L.A. Times, who reported on this red-hot invention by a movie actress, Hedy Lamarr, the government didn't quite know what to do with it, so the rest of the article talked about all the men who had submitted inventions and patents for the war effort and just quickly brushed her aside. And so that's the irony of the title, Beautiful. She was indeed Max Reinhardt, who was her director over in Europe prior to her coming to the States. Max Reinhardt had told the international press when she was doing a stage production he was directing in 1932, "This is the most beautiful girl in the world." So that moniker, that label, internationally stuck to her. And when she came over to the United States, she changed her name from Hedy Kiesler, which was her name, to Hedy Lamarr. And she is, I think, if people of film want to remember her at all, she's probably best remembered as Delilah in Cecil B. DeMille's Samson and Delilah. And that would probably be her definitive film role. However, she gave remarkable performances in a lot of roles that a lot of actresses wouldn't have touched. And as Robert Osborne, who did the foreword to my book, as Robert Osborne, who knew her personally, said, she did exactly what she was told to. Anybody who has ever worked in front of a camera knows what it is to concentrate and deliver and be natural. And she did exactly what her characters called for. And even though there's that slight lilting Vienna accent, if you watch her eyes when she's on film, she's working. And H.M. Pulham Esquire, 1941, is a brilliant film that she gave possibly one of her best performances, Tortilla Flat, as well, and how MGM rewarded her by turning in a couple of really remarkable performances. They threw her in White Cargo, a very risque motion picture. She was Tonda Leo. And that would have ruined any other actress of her caliber of that era. It would have ruined their career, but Hedy Lamarr somehow pulled it off, and the movie made millions. But at any rate, it's a fascinating life she had. It's a fascinating story. There's tragedy in it. There are certain things in the first part of the book, her life over in Europe. There are certain elements of her life that touch upon history. And I fell in love with her finally at the 11th hour. There were a lot of things going on when I wrote this book, a lot of personal things going on, and the worst thing a writer can do is to bring his own life into a book, editorialize or whatever, or be too emotional or not emotional enough. And there were, as life goes on with anybody who writes, you know, you have to divorce yourself from that, from your life, and go into the reality of the subject you're writing about. And at the 11th hour, Hedy Lamarr's son Anthony agreed to participate in the project, and I was able to talk and re-verify a lot of facts that I had already found in the book, but his input was most valuable on a personal level. And I heard a voice. It's, you know, you don't want to start talking in these esoteric terms, but I did finally find a voice. I remember when I started this project, I lived out west. I lived in Nevada for a year. And I remember I got a phone call from an important director who was planning a film project at that time. And I had just signed my contract with Macmillan, and she asked, "Have you found a voice yet for Hedy Lamarr?" And I thought, "Found a voice?" I said, "Oh," I told her, "of course I had found a voice," but I pondered that for the longest time. With Patricia Neal, I knew the lady for 20 years, and that whole project was so out of reality for a first-time author that I assumed that's how all my books were going to go, that I was going to, you know, of course, Hedy Lamarr had already passed away, and Gloria right. Swanson, my third book, she's already gone too. But every book, every project is different. And at that 11th hour, just right before the manuscript went into the publisher, something started telling me the reality of her life, and exactly, was I on the right track, or could I improve this, could I improve that? And I literally had to pull several key factors from various chapters and redo several things, because I knew exactly what I was doing. I wasn't hitting and missing on this. But I fell in love with Hedy Lamarr, and I wasn't for sure I was going to do that when I started this book. I wasn't for sure I was going to fall in love with Gloria Swanson, and you do, an author does. By the time they finish the manuscript, you've put all those pieces together. If you've done your work, if you've done your homework, if you've done your research, you have millions and millions and millions of pieces of this, that, and the other, some which is relevant, some which is not. But you put it together and try not to editorialize. You try to clear your own prejudices and your own thoughts and your own life out of your mind, and you put the book together. And I think I put Beautiful together pretty well. Her children were very pleased with it, and several of the people that assisted me when I did interview, et cetera, they were pleased with it as well. And so I'm really anxious to get your take when you finish the book. When you said that you had to think about it when you were reading the book, I hope your listeners understand that it's an easy book to read. I try not to write over anybody's head, but it's definitely a definitive biography. So there are a lot of facts, a lot of dates there. Some of them are not importante, but the color of an outfit that she wore or something like that, somebody might find that interesting. at any rate, I try to get every page to move, and certainly at the end of every chapter, I want the reader to continue on. So I definitely hope you find it an easy read, at least.
It is an easy read. I think with your writing, because I love your writing style. It's engaging. It makes you turn the page. I think what I spent a lot of time on, though, is, you know, when you're talking about a lot of the factual, you know, things that were going on, I kept thinking about what other world events were happening at the same time. So in my own head, I was kind of like going, okay, this is happening to her. What else is happening in the rest of the world based on this? Because I love history. I love World War II history, and I love that part of our world's timeline. And so I kept going back and thinking about all the other things that must have been going on that were contributing to this happening and that happening. And then, you know, just as we get through, because I want to ask you, after we're going to take a break in a couple of minutes, but I wanted to ask you about her marriage to Fritz and how, you know, she got away, because that in itself, I went back and reread a second time because I was just on pins and needles going, run! And you weren't sure if she was, you know, going to get, you know, obviously there's another, you know, 10,000, you know, words in the book. So I knew she was going to get out, but I was like, you didn't, if you're just reading it for the first time, you're like, I hope she gets out. This is going to be just, you know, edge of your seat suspense. And it was, I needed to take a little bit of a breath because it is, you know, this is what really happened to her. It wasn't just like, okay, this is a movie. You know, you could make a movie of this and people would be on the edge of their seats. But this actually really happened, and you captured it so brilliantly. And I have my hat's off to you for that. But I think just because of a lot of the drama that was going on, it just was, okay, I've got to catch my breath because otherwise, you know, I may faint if I turn that next page and, you know, we see what's going to happen.
Yeah, there was a lot of suspense there, and the thing is that I did in the first part of the book go into detail about the buildup of the fascist powers during that time she was married. She married Fritz in 1933, and of course that is when Hitler came to power. And Fritz, well, we'll talk about that shortly, but because of his position in armaments and armory, he was an important European figure during the buildup of these socialist countries, and Haiti was a part of that. It was through Fritz that she educated herself on wireless communication, and which later abetted us all because of her contribution. So there's a lot of history there in the first part of the book. When she gets to Hollywood, of course, it's a lot of backstory on each of the projects she did and what was going on in Hollywood primarily at that time, her marriages, her life, etc. But World War II intervened, and there were a lot of important things that she did during the war effort, aside from just the patent, that she deserves the patriotic nod that we should give her for her participation during World War II as well. And strangely, her last film was in 1957-58. She's largely forgotten by a lot of younger people. Mel Brooks, of course, had done his Blazing Saddles in 1973, and for all technical purposes for a whole generation, the name Haiti Lamar became a joke. But younger kids today now, when you ask do you know who Haiti Lamar is, most of them surprisingly will say, well, didn't she invent something? And that is so refreshing. I think that is a real blessing for her children as well, that her mother is getting the respect now 15 years after she has been gone. I think there is a lot to this woman that our whole civilization owes her that credit.
And I think this is a perfect time to take a quick break. Again, we're going to hear from two sponsors, It Matters Radio and our friends at Rainbow Brew out of Minneapolis, St. Paul. You might even know them, Stephen. And so we're going to hear from It Matters Radio and Rainbow Brew, and we'll be right back right after this.
Welcome to our discussion of It Matters Radio. Our guest today is Angus McWilliams.
Hey, laddie, let's get on with this thing. I'm on my way to a birthday party for Nessie.
You're throwing a birthday party for the Loch Ness Monster?
Well, first of all, it's not a monster. And second of all, I'm talking about niece Nessie. She's a wee bit of a lovely lass.
I see. Well, okay. Angus, can you give us your thoughts on It Matters Radio?
Aye, wonderful people. They had me on a while back to talk about my book.
Your what?
My book. I wrote a book about the adventures in Scotland.
Oh, I see. A book.
That's what I just said. What are you, deaf man?
It Matters Radio focuses on discovering new talent and bringing important indie artists on the air. Monica, Kenneth, and Carrie offer up meaningful conversation on new music, books, and fun topics. It's unlike any other radio program known to man and woman alike.
You can say that again.
Known to man and woman alike.
Just because I said you can say it again doesn't mean you have to say it again.
I'm just doing my best to show everyone that It Matters Radio basically brings variety, fun, and entertainment with a sincere desire to discover new topics and talent.
Why didn't you just say that?
I just did.
Hey, Letty, remind me when I can listen.
It Matters Radio is on every Thursday night, 9 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. Pacific.
You Americans with your different time zones. We only have one time zone in Scotland.
And that would be...
That would be the time to down a pint or two of ale.
It Matters Radio, for the best in conversation, music, books, and entertainment. Join us Thursday evenings at 9 Eastern, 6 Pacific. Discover the depth, diversity, meaningfulness, caring, guest-focused, friendly, enjoyable atmosphere of It Matters Radio with Ken, Monica, and Carrie.
That's a mouthful if I ever heard one.
Yes, and I'm going to go brush my teeth now. It Matters Radio.
When it comes to coffee, freshness is queen. That's why Rainbow Brew believes you should have the freshest coffee, roasted to order in small batches and delivered to your door within a couple days. Whether you're purchasing for a coffee shop, restaurant, or home, Rainbow Brew is your one-stop shop for fair trade and organic coffee. Offering many unique blends, including AM 950's own Blue State blend. That's Rainbow Brew, the Queen Bean, a proud sponsor of the Morning Grind. Online at rainbowbrew.com. Brew something good today.
I always love Rainbow Brew's commercial here because they're based out of Minneapolis, St. Paul. Stephen Michael Scherer is our VIP guest superstar tonight. We're here talking about his book called Beautiful, The Life of Hedy Lamarr. And before I bring Stephen back on, I just want to give big shout-outs to the folks at Rainbow Brew because I never knew you could actually make great-tasting coffee in the frozen tundra of Minneapolis-St. Paul, but they do, and I'm grateful that they are part of the program. They are also a small business. They're also an LGBT-owned business, so if you want to support either of those types of businesses in your local community or worldwide, go to rainbowbrew.com. If you order a coffee, make sure to like their Facebook page because they will give you coupons for valuable discounts. And then if you tell them, I heard you on Rated G Radio, they will actually do a happy dance in their store, and then the world is a better place. So go buy some Rainbow Brew coffee. Okay, we're joined again with Stephen Michael Scherer. We're talking about Beautiful, The Life of Hedy Lamarr. And I asked Stephen on the break, and I said, you know, selfishly, because I think we could do a five-part series on Hedy, but if we could talk about her earlier years, I was just fascinated. And I think that's, you know, whenever we meet famous people, we don't ever think that, oh, you had a childhood. Oh, you had family that you had to deal with. Oh, you had, you know, intrigue or things that happened. But she clearly, she had, a fascinating backstory that I never in a million years, if you would have said Hedy Lamarr, I would have ever said, oh, well, she grew up, da-da-da-da-da. And I would love it, Stephen, if you would talk to us a little bit about her origins as a Austrian, well, she was called princess by her father, but as, you know, a very well-to-do person in the Austrian Empire.
Well, she was an only child of a privileged family. Kiesler, her father, headed up one of the most important banks in Vienna at that time. They were of Jewish origin. However, most of the population in Vienna were practicing Catholics. Vienna was quite a melting pot of various European nationalities. Even the Balkan states, a lot of people came to Vienna during World War I. Vienna danced. It was very, very slightly affected with the effects of World War I. However, when Adolf Hitler wrote his Mein Kampf, he clearly stated in the first chapter what his feelings were about the Jews, particularly in Vienna, and if if he was in power, what he would do about that. So in 1933, Hetty was an only child. She was very privileged, as I said, was sent to some of the best schools. And at an early age, she knew she wanted to be an actress. She studied American movie magazines. Everything American fascinated her. She wanted to become a student of theatrical impresario Max Reinhardt, which she did. She acted in several plays with him, and she also made a handful of motion pictures, one of which starred a German actor, Hans Ruhlmann, who it was a comedy, and that particular film actually starred her opposite him. This was the film before Ecstasy, which she made in 1933. Hans Ruhlmann was an extremely good-looking, popular comedian that era in German-speaking countries and throughout Europe. He was actually one of Adolf Hitler's favorite actors, and he was also one of Anne Frank's favorite actors. Indeed, his picture is still on the wall at the Annex in Amsterdam. Hans Ruhlmann is probably, if he's remembered at all here in the United States, he had a small acting role in a 1965 motion picture called Ship of Fools with Lee Marvin and Vivian Leigh, and that's how I remembered him when I was a kid. I remembered who Hans Ruhlmann was. Also in that film, this particular film I'm talking about, was a German actor by the name of Kurt Garon. Kurt Garon, the name of the film was We Need No Money. There's a German translation of it, but I won't. It's in the book. Kurt Garon originated the role in Threepenny Opera. He actually sang Mack the Knife for the first time. He was a rotund Jewish actor, very extremely popular prior to 1933. The tragedy with Kurt Garon was when the fascists came into power in Germany, and especially when the Germans did the Anschluss of the takeover, if you will, of Austria in 1938. Kurt Garon escaped to another country in Europe. There was no escape for many Jewish artists of that time in Europe, and he was captured with his wife and sent to a concentration camp. He was ordered by the Germans to direct a propaganda film about the concentration camp Theresienstadt, which was a very notorious concentration camp. They glorified, they glamorized it, they fed the inmates, and then they brought in a film crew and ordered Kurt Garon to direct this movie to show, through the Red Cross, to show the international community that these concentration camps were just basically retirement homes for the German people.
Oh, my
people.
Gosh.
And as soon as the camera crews left, most of the population of Theresienstadt were sent to concentration camps, as were Kurt Garon and his wife. They were on the last train out. And right before they sent Kurt Garon and his wife to the gas chamber, they forced him at gunpoint to sing Mack the Knife. So was a reality that was going on in Germany, and it was a close enough reality to Hedy Kiessler's, Hedy Lamarr's life, that she knew, she realized at some point that she had to leave Europe. She married in 1933 Fritz Mandl, of Jewish origins as well, but he played both sides of the fence. He was considered an honorary Aryan, if you will, because he did supply armament, contrary to the peace agreements after World War One. He began supplying armaments to both Mussolini and Adolf Hitler. It is pretty much a fact that Hedy Lamarr and Hedy Kiessler and her husband Fritz Mandl actually dined with Mussolini. However, they would never have met Adolf Hitler. They would have never been introduced to Adolf Hitler. However, Mandel did supply the armaments for night after night. He was quite wealthy. As a matter of fact, he was the third or fourth wealthiest man in Austria. He night after night, he would have his cronies at their dining room table. She was a trophy wife. She retired from film and theater, and for 5 years, she did not act, but she spent many a night at the table listening to Fritz and his cronies talk about wireless communication and how the Germans were planning to do this and that. And even though she was beautiful, she was not stupid. Hedy Lamarr's mind was very, very sharp. She was a brilliant woman, very, very intelligent. You asked at one point in one of our private conversations about her father. Her father, I think if there was any man in Hedy Lamarr's life that she truly, truly loved, it was her father, who passed away in 1935. She was only 21 at the time, and she was very close to her father. He adored her. He used to take apart clocks and used to take apart machinery and explain the function to her, even as a young girl. So she was always fascinated on what made things work, mechanical things, why this was able to function. And throughout her life, other than the patents, she was always inventing. Indeed, when she was in Hollywood in the 1940s, she dated Howard Hughes for a very brief amount of time. And he actually, his interest in aviation, of course, piqued her sensibilities, and he supplied her actually with a couple of scientists and the wherewithal to tinker around, as they called it in those days, with various inventions. She tried to develop a bullion cube-like cube that you could throw in, toss into water, and it would come out some sort of soft drink. She had all sorts of little things she was always tinkering with, because she knew at the outbreak of the war, at least in Europe, after the Anschluss of 1938, her own mother was still there. And she knew that the jeopardy and the well-being of her mother was of vast importance. And through MGM and Louis B. Mayer, they were able to get her mother out to London, where her mother survived the Blitzkrieg of 1939-1940. And finally made it over to Canada and eventually Hollywood in 1942. But Hedy was very involved with what was going on with her fellow countrymen and with Europe in as a whole. And she knew firsthand dangers they were suffering over there. So of all the actors, in Hollywood in the 1940s, when it was interesting, I know I'm jumping around here, it was interesting when I did my research on some film footage at USC, there's a lot of Hearst newsreel footage of Hedy during the war bond rallies, and she is probably at her best when she is emotionally talking, when she doesn't have a script in front of her. And at these bond rallies, she's talking from her heart, and she's talking with passion. Mm. And she's sharp enough to not have, all the catcalls and whistles throw her. She was there for a purpose. And in one day, more than any other star, male or female, through all four war bond rallies, in one day, Hedy Lamarr sold more war bonds in one day than any other star. And that was something like $6 or $9 million, it's in the book, $6 or $9 million dollars of 1940s money in one day.
Huge.
So she was quite a patriot. She became an American citizen finally in 1953. But at any rate, sitting with Fritz Mandel and his cronies, she absorbed what they were talking about, and she didn't really pay much attention to it until she realized that she was a captive in her own home. Fritz Mandel, she was a trophy wife, as I said, and he was a bit older than her, but he had her trailed. He never wanted her out of sight. She had various affairs, this, that, and the other, and the legend has it then she escaped from Fritz Mandel in September of 1937, fled to London, where she met Louis B. Mayer, and he gave her a contract, and they sailed the Atlantic on the Normandy, and she went to Hollywood. Well, that makes Louis B. Mayer the hero, and it makes Hedy Lamarr the discovery. However, she had made a motion picture in 1933 called Ecstasy, and it was very well received as an art film. There's very little dialogue in it. It has a beautiful musical score, gorgeous cinematography. However, it also has two scenes which, when the movie was exploited here in the United States in 1935, it was considered pornographic. There's a scene of Hedy Lamarr running naked through the woods and jumping in a lake and taking a swim. There's also a scene of Hedy Lamarr, close-ups of Hedy, enjoying the passions of the man she's with, in close-up, just her facial reactions. Those two particular scenes didn't make a ripple in Europe when the film was released in 1933. As a matter of fact, I was able to collect a couple of contemporary reviews of that day. And even in London, they talked about the cinematography, they talked about the music, they talked about the performances. However, in the puritanical United States, there was a fellow who wanted to exploit the film and bring it over to the United States. And when it did, it played road shows. It was considered pornographic. So Hedy Kiessler became notorious. Hedy had actually met Louis B. Mayer in 1934 at the home of Max Reinhardt. She and Fritz were invited. And Mayer told her at that time that we make clean motion pictures, and unfortunately you can't speak English, and so I don't think we can use you. When Hedy did leave Fritz Mandel, I think... Well, there aren't contemporary letters at that time. There are letters from 1938, 1939 from Fritz, but there is a possibility that Fritz helped her escape. Fritz was funneling most of his money from his factories into Switzerland and into South America. He was preparing his out, but he had to find a way for Hedy to escape as well. Because in the actuality of the whole marriage, and they did divorce in 1937, the actuality of the whole marriage was Fritz and Hedy kept in contact with each other through telephone and through correspondence up until his death in 1977. So there is speculation, and there are people who do believe that he helped her escape. There are letters, which I can't really talk about right now. There are letters that have been discovered and have been translated that will appear in the documentary that will probably better define this period of Hedy's life before Hollywood. And after she came to Hollywood, there are letters from Fritz to her mother that are very poignant and very revealing. And again, this information will be talked about in the documentary. So I'd stay tuned for that documentary. Hedy Lamarr's life, I thought, before she came to Hollywood, was quite full and quite dramatic and quite impressive. There are a lot of names that are dropped in those first few chapters that are who are historical people. And so I would love to see the first part of her life prior to coming to Hollywood, even prior to the invention, the patent. I would love to see that dramatized because it is almost unbelievable, like you said, and it hasn't been written about. I'm glad that my book was the first book to talk about in depth about that part of her life. Not just because I find it fascinating, but I've had a lot of feedback from readers and from people who have inquired about that era that have appreciated the fact that at least my figures are right, and I think I told the story in a moving, compelling way.
Well, I will tell you the thing that I struggled with, not as a reader, but just because I felt so like you've got to get out of there, you know, when she's trying to get out of Austria. That honestly, because I spent a lot of time going back over that, going, this poor lady. But you know, I never even thought about the fact that maybe Fritz, you know, was you know, keeping her there until he could make sure she could get out safely. Or maybe there was, you know, a fix in somewhere else that, you know, they were aware that, you know, something was going to be taking place, and he was doing that to protect her, maybe.
Well, I think it was very fortuitous that she got out of there when she did, because it was within a year that Austria was taken over, so by the Germans, and so it was a period that she perhaps waited too long. I don't know, but the timing was right. In hindsight, everything seems to have had a pattern, or seems to have had a blueprint that, and of course MGM worked it out. Louis B. Mayer was he was this, that, and the other, and people have written about Louis B. Mayer for years and years and years. And I tried to be honest about him in the book. However, he did bring a lot of the Jewish artists over to the United States by signing them to contracts, and he was benevolent in that sense. He was perhaps a ruthless man. But
Stephen, a question on that, because in the book it talks about an agent that he met that was bringing a lot of Jewish talent to Mayer, mm-hmm. and there's a line in there saying something to the effect of that she wasn't exploiting either the fact that they were Jewish or the fact that they had certain talents or abilities, and I think that was what you alluded to, that Mayer was able to say, okay, well, come on over here, we're going to get you a job over here in Hollywood.
He did offer her like $50 a week, and she stood up and said, no, I can't take that. I was a star in Europe before you, and walked out of his hotel suite. And then when she reconsidered, because she was faced with deportation back to Austria from England, when she reconsidered her situation, she boarded the ship with I think $60 or $80 in her American money in her pocket, plus one designer gown and what jewels she had remaining with her. And throughout the passage across the Atlantic, she stunned every male passenger on board the ship. And Louis B. Mayer, by the time she arrived in New York, Louis B. Mayer had offered her $500 a week and a leading lady contract under the stipulation she learned English. So, yes, he was more or less getting her out of Europe, but he didn't realize the impact she had on certainly men, and also women on board took notice of her as well. And so, yes, there are many things that Louis B. Mayer did that were built up quite a lot in the publicity releases about how he saved her from this. But, of course, he changed her name to Hedy Lamarr. He wanted no reference to ecstasy if he could help it, and certainly no reference to her being Jewish, which is the irony of those times, considering Hollywood was built by primarily Jewish pioneers in mm-hmm. film. And however, it was very unpopular at that time to be Jewish, unquote, if you will. I think there's a contemporary thread of this fabric, which runs even in today's civilization, that sometimes your religion gets in the way of a good story, as MGM would say. And so they rewrote her biography when she came to the United States. So it was a sign of the times. However, sometimes our history repeats itself, and so we have to. I think there's a reason I write film biography, because I think motion pictures, arguably, is perhaps one America's one true art form. And as a historian, I have to impart on the reader why the importance of motion picture, because it set our culture, because it set who we are. It taught us how to behave, how our grandparents were able to see the world, how our parents were able to learn how to treat people, how as a child of the television age, how America was supposed to be. You know, Lord knows my family tried to be the Beavers, Beaver Cleaver family, and all that. But film and motion picture are very, very important to our culture and to who we are. And I think that period in Haiti's life, you know, one must understand what was going on in the world at that time to put everything in perspective. It's just not a story about this, that, and the other, and, well, that's unheard of. Well, you have to understand what was going on during that period. And so to me, it was a great education just to learn about the 30s and the 40s. Certainly, there was a lot more to Hedy Lamarr being at MGM. Patricia Neal was more or less a freelance actress. Gloria Swanson, her contracts were primarily with Paramount. So I was able to research and study those film studios very, very much. And because all three of those women lived in different eras, however they overlapped, and their stories are quite different, and their careers are quite different. A lot of people involved in their lives as either co-workers or friends, and they're in all three books. So there's an overlap of history throughout all three of the books. And then Hedy Lamarr's life, I think, is a learning lesson, if you will, because, again, the whole title of the book, Beautiful, there's such an irony in that. She was so much more than beautiful, and people tend to overlook the fact that there was a life here, a very important life, and a life that contributed to our society as it is today. So anyway, I guess that's part one of our story about Hedy Lamarr.
This is one of the reasons why I love you on the show here, Stephen, is that you do put things in a historical context. It makes you, it's an enjoyable thing. You know, there are some books that you read and you're like, oh, this makes my brain hurt. Yours is not a brain hurt book. Yours, at least for me, it's a very enjoyable read, but you do stop to think about, here's what was happening at that time. Here's what was going on in the world. And, you know, it's much more than just, well, you know, Hedy Lamarr arrived in Hollywood in 1940. Then she made, you know, this film, and then she made that film, and she married this person, and then she died. It's not that. Get so much more. It's a rich experience that really makes you just take note of how spectacular these people were. I had Tony G out of Hackensack. And apparently he had been researching something earlier today, and he says, she is truly fascinating woman. I didn't know all of this. And I said, well, that's why he's on the show tonight, Tony. And so he got a big kick out of that. We are going to have you back sometime. We'll figure out the dates in 2016, okay. But I'd love to have you back at least for minimum of one, but I could probably do two more talks about Hedy Lamarr. And if you would indulge me, that would be such a pleasure to have you back.
Oh, I would be delighted to, Garrett. You know that, yeah.
Okay. And so for everybody who is listening to the show live tonight or on Technicolor, because we do that too, we love everybody listening on demand, there is a link on the show page. It says, buy all of Stephen Michael Shear's books on Amazon here. You just click that, and it's going to take you to his Amazon page, and then you just go bing, 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 and you can get them all on Kindle. You can get them on paperback or hard copy, and that's all a wonderful thing. It's the holiday, so buy 10 copies of each, one for you, 9 for your family. Friends, you know, help support the cause, because, you know, this is what great historical writing is about. It's capturing these moments where you're, as a reader, you're going, get out of there now, run! But you have to just come back and take the journey. So, Stephen, I thank you for tonight. Also, for
my pleasure.
I'm going to play just a little snippet of my Christmas song called Guess What, It's Christmas Time. If you'd like to see me put together a holiday wreath with Christmas ornaments, I filmed something yesterday that's on my Facebook page. If you're not friend me, and we'll have lots of fun, and we'll see you live tomorrow with Zoe Niklaus, and we'll be taking your calls. Here's a little secret. Call in at 6:45 if you want to start asking a question tomorrow night, because the phone lines are going to go nuts. Have a great night, everyone.
Christmas with the sunshine in the trees. You might not even think of Santa Claus with his dogs down by the beach. Oh, their tails they are all wagging, wagging here to there. And the joyous sounds of barking without care. Bells and bows, how they love to lick your nose. And old or one with a big brown nose. Either way, you'll feel so happy with love from Santa's sleigh and playing with your puppy Christmas Day. Bathe and clip with bells and bows. How they love to lick your nose. And old Saint Nicky knew.
You've been listening to
Rated G Radio.